The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I want to start by, of course, with a warm welcome again for those of you who just joined us. Very warm welcome. And then just to check in, we sent you some homework, or let's say this, but maybe, I don't know this word homework, maybe we'll say opportunities for further exploration. Maybe we could say something like that. And maybe to read Tom Jeff's article, Befriending the Suttas, to look at Lee Brazenton's so many translations of the Metta Sutta. For those of you who looked on that, it was quite impressive. And Kim commented to me like, wait, there's a new one. There's one more translation out there. So I appreciate this very much that Lee is keeping us up to date. And even last time, we kind of did a little whistle-stop tour of some websites that have suttas with an encouragement to go explore, you know, whatever is interesting you, whatever is, finds intriguing or compelling, as well as an encouragement maybe to chant or memorize or, you know, just engage with the suttas in a way that's meaningful for you, recognizing that not everybody's a scholar. Not everybody has to dig into them. It's not the only way, right, to practice. But for some people, they just haven't had an introduction. We recognize that some people have in their old hut and they know a lot of this. But for some people, they haven't. So just this kind of introduction. So now we'd love to hear from you guys how this was since the last class, or maybe if there's some questions since the last class. Here we go. So, yes, Bess.
Hi. Well, I was just shocked by the difference between the translations. Just amazed. I've never done this before. So I took a really easy or basic passage, which was the first two verses of the Dhammapada. And S. Warren and Gill both used mind, but Bhikkhu Tanisaro used heart, and Mueller used thought. So, I just thought that was really interesting that they were so divergent, and they all had a little explanation about why, but they're just so divergent. I mean, between heart and thought, that's really not equivalent. So, yeah.
Thank you, Bess. Thank you. Yeah. So you're pointing to this Pali word chitta, but maybe more importantly, you're pointing to how now in the contemporary time, we have this real distinction between thought and heart and mind. It just seems so obvious. Of course, there's a separation, but this just points out, was there a separation in the Buddha's time? Between heart and mind?
Okay.
Maybe it was just all inner life was all together. They didn't make this distinction between rational and emotional or something like that. Right, they just kind of organized the human experience differently. And part of the beauty of that, in my view, is helps us to see some of our assumptions that we have and some of the ways that we consider how the world is and how we organize our experiences and things like that. So, but thank you for pointing that out. That's a really good one, this difference between heart and mind. And I don't remember... There's some translator who calls it heart-mind because they can't quite decide. And maybe they want to point to this idea that we don't have to make a distinction or something like that.
Mm. Cool.
Kim, I don't know if you want to add anything or... No. Yeah. Did anybody else look at like maybe the different translations of the Metta Sutta that we sent in that link? How many? I think there's 20 different translations now. But who's counting? 20 is quite a lot. Yes, Catherine. Oh.
Claire's hand first.
Okay, we'll have to do Claire and then Catherine.
No worries. I printed out all of the, I tried to print it out. It was really hard, the translations of the Metta Sutta, but I kind of figured it out with a lot of different sheets. And I was just kind of looking each section by section because they had them kind of divided up by section, which I found really useful. And it was interesting because first of all, my mind wanted to just like decide which one I liked best. And I think it was Chris or someone that said it last time that there's this, you know, wanting to prefer. But then as I kind of spent time with it, it just ended up being kind of a more overall picture of the whole thing, which I thought was super useful. And weirdly enough, it made me feel like I wanted to go back to the original and like learn Pali. Like I can see why people want to do that, because you're like, well, how can so many people have so many different translations? So it was cool. It's a really interesting exercise.
Great. Thank you, Claire. Kim, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Just that I love that idea of getting an overall picture by looking at different ones. This is a mundane example, but when I cook, I look at 5 different recipes for something and then I make something that's not exactly any of them, but I get the idea from all of them of what the main proportions are and so forth. But this is a slightly different cooking of the texts, but nonetheless, it's a great way to do it. And maybe just as a side comment, those of you who are familiar with the Samyutta Nikaya, it's organized by topics. And if you read all of the suttas in one of the Samyuttas, you get a picture of that topic in the same way.
Yeah, there's a fullness. Maybe we could use that word, a fullness of understanding when we look at different translations and different suttas. Yeah, great. Thank you, Kim. And Catherine.
I read the Metta Suttas out loud and all the different ones. And I was just, my question is there an easy way to find out what range of time historically we have between all these different translations? Are there ones that are from 1876 and ones that are from 1945, or are there just kind of like maybe mostly I want to know what's the most modern one?
That's a great question. You know, I don't have the translators in front of me. I don't know, Kim, do you know? Like, not if Gil Fronstahl's on there.
I suspect, you know, most of them are modern, but yeah. Most of them are pretty contemporary, but there may be some early ones. That's kind of my intuition, but I don't know each one.
Yeah, okay. And I would say if somebody named Rice Davids is on there, he's one of the very first translators ever into English. So that would be in the late 1800s. And maybe, of course, Max Müller, the one we looked at earlier, and there's a few. Yeah, that's a great question.
Mostly modern, though, you'd say.
Yeah.
Since there wasn't. Okay, great.
And by modern, I think I mean something like 1980s to present, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fits my definition. Thanks.
For me, something that's really noteworthy is that some of you know that, of course, that the Pali Canon has 5 books, and roughly we could say 5 books. And one of the books didn't get a modern translation until, what, just 3 years ago, 4 years ago? I'm not sure when the Angudara came out, right? And the last bit translated into English just happened, like 1 year or 2 years ago, the Avadana. So, Avadana. So, I mean, that is... This is so, when we think of like other religions, this one is, you know, Buddhism, especially from the Pali Canon, is just a baby in the Western world. In the English-speaking world, maybe I should say. Well, let's see. If there are, or I see some. Yes, Sheila.
I noticed that the distinction between the use at the very end of the word womb versus I think it was not reborn again. And I thought that that, and then another one was the end of suffering. I thought that was really, for me, it just noticed that difference and how today, you know, in the 21st century, we don't resonate with never again reborn in the womb, right? We have a different perspective on rebirth. No, we're informed so much by science in a way that the origin of these works were not informed by science in the same way that we're informed today. And I think of that as being interesting.
Mm. Yes, of course. From thousands of years ago, they had a different understanding.
Right. And I think that that also applies to the heart mind, right, that you brought up. Right, that in our day we train our minds in a way completely different than they did thousands of years ago.
I would say that a little bit different, that we have an idea that the mind is associated with the brain. That's where the difference is.
Yes.
And then I want to point to something, and I don't know, maybe Kim, you have something to say here too, but this idea of not being reborn in the womb is actually something specific in kind of the Buddhist cosmology. That is, you may be reborn, but not as a human. You would be reborn in a celestial realm, in a heavenly realm, is what's being pointed at here. That's why they're saying not reborn in a womb, just to make it clear that it's not that you're completely awakened, it's just that you'll go to a heavenly realm next.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. So maybe we'll move on here. So I just want to, as Kim had mentioned last time, so we'll do a little bit of a transition in class three. So the first two classes, we talked about this idea of inquiry, investigation. I like to think of it as rolling up our sleeves and kind of really engaging with the material as opposed to just passively receiving it, but engaging with it, inquiring, questioning. And then the last one was about suttas. Okay, we have this literature, this Buddhist literature, considered sacred, considered scripture by some. And what, you know, how can we engage with that? And might it be a support for us? And then now we're looking at particular topics. And one word that we might use for today is ethics. But ethics sounds like maybe it's something about rules and this word of morality or something. But ethics is one of those trainings in which you're never finished. It's like how you are in the world, how you show up with all your interactions with others. Every single one. So ethics kind of covers that huge, giant topic of just interacting with others as well as yourself. So it's something that our lifelong that we work with and that we engage with. So it's so much more than just bearing out the precepts and following them, even though that's part of it. But it's more about how do we interact with others, treat others? How do we, in all different ways, body, speech, and mind with others? So maybe with that as an introduction, I'll turn it over to Kim. Thank you.
Yeah, I think this is starting right out with the heart of the Dharma life, you know, the title of this class. So I want to speak a little bit about friendship and relationship in the form of being a good friend in the world. So a lot of our daily life involves relationship, of course, with other people, but also with ourselves and with nature sometimes. And so living in accordance with the Dharma is naturally going to include how we relate. So it's true that other people influence us, and sometimes that's what we think of first, but equally so, we are influencing the world just from our way of being, just like what Diana was saying. So that's, let's sort of start to explore this topic a bit. The Buddha says this explicitly in a sutta where he says, "I see no other thing that is so much responsible for the arising of unwholesome qualities in a person as bad friendship, and nothing so helpful for the arising of wholesome qualities as good friendship." So it is certainly important to choose to associate with good people. That's pretty fundamental. It often comes at the beginning of lists that are about this topic. But as we live more fully into our Dharma life, and I know many of you are pretty long-term practitioners here, I would say that the flip side of that starts becoming equally important, or even more so, which is how are we manifesting Dharma qualities that would be beneficial for others? You know, to what degree are we able to support the world through the way that we are? So I want to speak now about how our presence in the world can help to bring about wholesome qualities around us. I was, just a little aside, I was interested to notice that as I researched this topic in the suttas, it was certainly true that there were many more suttas about the first case, you know, cases where you would be trying to find somebody like a teacher or like a good friend to help guide you on the path. And that makes sense in the context of the suttas. But in any of those cases, we could easily just turn the sutta around into a self-reflection. You know, to what degree am I being able to offer this to others? How could I exemplify these qualities such that others could rely on me? So there are a number of qualities that are highlighted in the Buddhist teachings as especially worth emulating, shall we say. And so in particular, there's one sutta that talks about four of them: faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. So I'll just read. This is from AN 854. "Herein, in whatsoever village or market town a householder dwells, he or she associates, converses, engages in discussions with householders or householders' children, whether young and highly cultured or old and highly cultured, full of faith, full of virtue, full of generosity, full of wisdom. They act in accordance with the faith of the faithful, with the virtue of the virtuous, with the generosity of the generous, and with the wisdom of the wise. This is called good friendship." So it ends with saying that all of that long speech before that was just saying what it is to be a good friend, which is that you are associating with other good people who have at least some of these qualities, and then you act in line with those. So then, and this makes perfect sense, you know, it doesn't mean that everybody you know has to exemplify all four of these qualities to a high degree. That'd be nice, of course, but you know, but maybe you know somebody who's particularly generous. That's just one of the qualities you think of immediately when you think of them. It's totally appropriate, according to this sutta, to emulate the generosity of that person, figuring how could I do that more. And then in line with what I'm talking about here, we can turn it around and ask, well, to what degree am I able to manifest each of these four qualities, you know, such that others might be able to emulate that. And so it's not that we would, you know, make a big deal out of this or take on an identity around this, or certainly we wouldn't talk about it explicitly, but it does mean that if you were practicing in this way of wanting to be a good friend to the world, we would look for opportunities to do each of these four things, for example. And I don't think we have to be excellent at all of them, but, you know, we can try. What works for us. There is a somewhat subtle dimension at play here. I know from my own experience that I once had a friend who was very attuned to animals. That was kind of her thing in the world. And she, I think, worked, her work was to work on protecting endangered species. And she also was also just aware of all the animals around her. She had a mind that looked for animals and appreciated them. And it was very interesting because whenever I was with her, I would see more animals, even though she wasn't giving me a guided tour of the world. I'm sure she would have if I'd asked, but just being around her, it's like I felt more attuned that way also. So it was clear that, you know, even sort of subconsciously somehow that was coming just from her way of being in the world. And so, you know, realizing that, we can start to think, oh, I should, you know, I can be take care with my mind and my heart and my attention and these sorts of things, because other people are going to be feeling that. Other people around me are going to be feeling that. So I think this was positive in that I probably tuned in myself to whatever connection I had with animals that maybe I didn't really appreciate so much in my everyday life. I mean, I do like animals, but it's not my work in the way it was for her. And so I probably deepened my own compassion and connection with that thing in myself in a way that I wouldn't have without her presence. So it's just her way of being. I think we could summarize to say that through a good friend, we see our own good more clearly. And so this is something that we can then offer to others. So here's a sutta that focuses more specifically on the actions that friends do for each other. This is from AN 735. A friend endowed with seven qualities is worth associating with. Which seven? I'll alternate genders. He gives what is hard to give. She does what is hard to do. He endures what is hard to endure. She reveals her secrets to you. He keeps your secrets. When misfortunes strike, she doesn't abandon you. When you're down and out, he doesn't look down on you. A friend endowed with these seven qualities is worth associating with. So, we see that spiritual friends give in a way that is not just casual. You know, they say what's hard to say. They do what's hard to do. If things are difficult for you, they don't have any judgment of that in certain ways. And so, it reminds me of a time when I was in, just as a simple example, I was in Sri Lanka a few years ago, and I was on a retreat in a retreat center, and my roommate was a Sri Lankan woman. And like retreats here, we all had our yogi jobs, and her job was to take the trash out of an upstairs kitchen area and down the outside stairwell to the trash can. And one day she went to do that job, and she didn't notice that outside the door there were a bunch of monkeys hanging around on the stairs. And when she came out the door, they grabbed the trash bag from her, and she immediately, you know, let it go and went inside, because monkeys are kind of dangerous. You don't fight, you don't mess with them when they're aggressive like that. And they proceeded to tear up the bag and spread the trash everywhere, all over the stairs. It was a big, big mess. And it took a while for all of that to resolve, and people were gathered around the door watching, and, you know, kind of our entertainment for the day, but also not so entertaining. And, you know, when finally the monkeys were done and went away, and other people had kind of wandered off to the hall. But, you know, my friend felt kind of bad about that and wanted to complete her job. So I stayed with her, and we spent quite a while mopping the stairs, you know, running water down them. And then they didn't have any hose or anything. So it was buckets and little mops. And, you know, it took a while and it was messy and it was very hot outside. So we got all sweaty and dirty. But I felt really good about just staying with her and doing that. And it was actually just as good as going to sit. So, you know, that's kind of a trivial example in some ways, but it's just a simple way that we support each other as doing some of these things that are not so pleasant to do for each other. So friendship maybe is more of a verb than a noun, we could say, in some sense. And then I think there's another aspect of good friendship that's worth stating explicitly, even though it's, I think, implicit in what we've talked about so far, which is in particular speech that is kind and wise and gentle and clear. I think that's very important as an aspect of friendship. The Buddha says that there are four qualities of true, non-divisive, not harsh, and not frivolous are the key qualities for skillful speech. And so in, you know, regular life, this would include speaking words of connection and appreciation and gratitude and support. And that is another way that we help wholesome qualities grow in other people. It's not just making nice or, you know, chit-chatting or something. It actually, by appreciating another person, for example, you help them recognize that they have whatever you're appreciating. You know, if you say, wow, I really appreciate that you helped me with this and that you were so patient with my learning it. They might not think of themselves as a patient person, but when you say it that way, then they realize, oh yeah, I guess that was. And so that quality grows in them a little bit because they recognize it. So this is a way that we can help support others and help wholesome qualities grow in them. And then, you know, even on certain occasions, being a good friend can include constructive criticism, because, of course, we do grow wholesome qualities, but also we need to see the places that we're not seeing. And that's, you know, as you've been on the path for a while, you realize that half the challenge is that you can't see what you need to see. And, you know, it's easier to see things in other people sometimes. So Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote in an essay called Association with the Wise, "The task of the noble friend is not only to provide companionship in the treading of the way. The truly wise and compassionate friend is one who, with understanding and sympathy of heart, is ready to criticize and admonish, to point out one's faults, to exhort and encourage, perceiving that the final end of such friendship is growth in the Dhamma." So we can gently criticize if we're doing it for spiritual growth, but you know, we have to be careful. But I would say that maybe in, just to wrap it up, we can say also that friendship is kind of a process and we go through stages of friendship. You know, good friendship is always important, but maybe we start out where we're looking for good friends. You know, we're new on the path and we need the steadiness of people who are wise and clear and have some self-understanding. And then we can emulate that in the way that was talked about in the sutta. And then as we do that, we start to find friends that are more like us, and we can have Dharma discussions like we do in our breakout groups, for example. And there's a lot of really good learning that comes from collegial relationships with other people on the path. This is probably a huge, you know, probably doesn't ever end, that part. And then for some people, there's also a maturing into being a support for others. You know, you grow to be a big enough tree that somehow others can come and shade themselves under it. And that's also a very beautiful stage. I think all of these are relevant all the time. We can, you know, we can be more conscious about bringing in these different forms of friendship. And so, you know, over time, we become the trees that support others. And this is probably the best way that we can pay back those who supported us early on, is by continuing that stream. Yeah, so along those lines, we're going to have some breakout groups now. And I think Diana has, have they been set up? Or should I set them up?
I set them up.
Okay, so, great.
I'll push the button when it's time to go to help us. But Kim, at the beginning, you talked about there's these four qualities. Can you just, it's faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. Can you just, again, just put a few words around those four qualities?
Yeah, so faith, or also called confidence, would be just our sincerity and respect for the path. And then generosity or virtue is next. So virtue is this quality we're talking about today, is being a wholesome example for others, living well. And then generosity is, of course, giving, but also kind of open-heartedness. You know, I think generosity includes just the general openness that we bring to things. We give our presence. And wisdom is the Dharma understanding of what leads to actual happiness in the world.
Fantastic. Great. So for this breakout room, there'll be three or four of you in a room. And let's go in order of I don't know, I can't remember what I've done in this group, but you know, this class. So we'll do the sum of the last two numbers of your phone number. So if the last two numbers of your phone number are 99, then you're 18 and you're going last. But if the last two numbers of your phone number are 00, the sum is 0 and you're going first. So just some more, you know, just sum up the last two numbers of your phone number, and you can go in numerical order. Okay, now that I've said this, that you're going to go in numerical order, we'd like to have this, that Kim talked about how there's these four qualities to emulate and that really can support a good friendship and, of course, ethics and relationships. Faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. And I'm right now putting this in the chat box, because if you are first in the order, you can do faith. If you're do faith, and then second one will be virtue, third will be generosity, and fourth will be wisdom. And then the question is, how, there's a number of ways in which we might promote this or think about this. But what are ways in which we can manifest these, that we can, like, what are some practical ways, or let's bring this into our Dharma life. So how can we, like, work with or express, or maybe I'll use that word, express, faith, virtue, generosity, or wisdom? And so each one of you has been assigned one of these. I don't know yet which one of you has which. But just to say a little bit about that, about how it might be. And for those of you who are in groups of three, you're lucky that you get to choose which one not to do, either to not do number one or to not do number four. So I guess maybe that's a little conversation that you'll have be there. And then maybe part of this is, if you have time, we're going to have 12 minutes. So if you have time, is there also a way in which you might, like, go that extra mile? How might this one, whichever quality you've been assigned, how can you go that extra mile for your friend with this? Like, how, that's one way to show up that way. And then I'll, of course, we're not going to criticize each other. We're not going to give each other, you know, advice. You really shouldn't say that or anything like that. This is more just an opportunity for us to say out loud maybe some ideas that we haven't quite put our thoughts together yet. So just an opportunity to create the conditions in which we might put together some thoughts about this. But you don't have a lot of time. So you don't, you're not going to get it perfect. You're not going to get it, everything in there. But just what are some ideas which you can bring one of these four qualities to relationships as part of ethics, friendships, and maybe Dharma life, that you can bring this to life. So that is kind of a long introduction. I'd like to send you off into these breakout rooms now. So here we go. Have fun. Okay. A little moment of panic. Like, oh, nobody's coming back. They all left. But I see you guys found your way back. So now we would just like to open it up to see if there's some questions or comments. How was that in the small group, to be assigned something that isn't of your own choosing and kind of had to go with your own definition or something? But how was that? Was there any aha moments? Was there any maybe new appreciations, understanding, questions?
About faith, one of the, I think it was Catherine, I don't have names very well, she mentioned that consistency was part of being friendly and having faith. And I really liked that. I never thought about faith as being consistent, but it is. It's like being true. It was nice.
Thank you. Thank you, Risa. Yan Kui.
So I think my brain power is a little slow tonight. It's nighttime here on the East Coast. So I'm having a hard time making the connection between ethics and what I understood with these four qualities of friendships. What in being in relationship with friends, energy between us, generate, help each other with virtue and with dana and with wisdom. How do these, can you just make a few more links between this and sila? I mean, with virtue or like, do you understand my question?
Kim?
Actually, I missed a little bit of your question in that for me, at least, it sounded like your connection faded out in and out a bit. Did I understand that you asked for a little clarity on what might have been possible answers around or offerings around virtue among those four?
My question is more about how you're teaching sila today. Today's topic is sila. And how are you framing these four qualities that can be generated within a friendship to sila?
Oh, okay. So maybe Diana will have something to say too, but maybe as a kind of a top level, I would say that because most of us are somewhat more experienced practitioners, we can think about how we're manifesting these four qualities in ways that will help bring them out in other people. As, you know, being a good friend in the world. And that's done partly through things that we, just the way that we are, and maybe also through our kind and wise speech of appreciation and other things like that. Anything else, Diana?
Yeah, so I'll just say this, that we're defining sila and really broadly in the way that we interact with others. It's really big. And that is actually what sila is. Sometimes we tend to think like, oh, it's the five precepts or the eight precepts or whatever it is, or 10 skillful actions, whatever it is. But we're defining sila in this broad way. Again, in the context of most of you, or not all of you, are experienced practitioners. So you know the basics of sila, of the five precepts. So I think that's where we're going. Risa.
I think this word was brought up when you were introducing the topic, but I think it'll help to think of it as relationship, interconnectedness. Relationship is a big word for me with sila. How do I interbeing?
Thank you, Risa. David.
Just to riff on what Risa just observed there, I found when I was working with my group, it was really hard to define the different qualities that were described in terms of faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom without invoking the other qualities. So I was talking about generosity, but generosity involved virtue and faith and wisdom involved faith and virtue and generosity. So like when I'm practicing the Brahmaviharas, what I was noticing was how interconnected they all are. And to actually break it down and define one was actually quite challenging without invoking the other qualities. So it was an interesting exercise, but I was really noticing how connected they were as qualities. So,
but I don't know, Kim, do you want to say something? I just want to say, I think that's fantastic to notice this. right? So the Buddha likes to make these lists and we like to make them neat and tidy. It's helpful to memorize them. But Kim, you know, I heard this phrase that you said one time, is that we start to notice if we just pull one thread of a quality, we start to see like, actually this thread is related to so many other things. Yeah, it's quite something. Okay, so, or Dawn, do you have a comment or?
Just a real quick observation. A couple of us talked about how we take these into relationships differently, whether it's our Dharma practitioner friends, they might be nuanced one way, whereas it's our non-practitioner friends, you know, it has a little different flavor to it. Maybe not quite as, you know, deep there, but there is, a couple of us noticed that difference. I was just curious.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, right? Just if we have work colleagues, we probably interact with them in a different way than we do with our family, right? It's kind of like in different settings, we have different types of relationships, but yeah, maybe some of the language we use or depth we use or something like that. Okay, so I'm thinking that we'll take a break. And how about if we come back to 5 minutes after the hour? So in 9 minutes, if you're on the West Coast, that's 4:05. If you're on the East Coast, 7:05. And we'll see you in a little bit.